Your Honor, may it please the court, my name is Jordan Factor, bar number 38126. I represent McGillis Investment Company. With me at counsel table is Patrick Vallone. The district court applied the elements of claim preclusion to bar McGillis from litigating an issue. The court ruled that McGillis should have litigated the validity of the assignment claim in the Utah action. The validity of the assignment is not a claim, it is an issue. A claim is a claim for relief or a cause of action. An issue is an issue of fact or law litigated as part of a claim for relief. Whether the assignment validly conveyed McGillis's interest in the property is an issue of fact or law relevant to the party's competing quiet title claims.
Counsel, can I just, and I apologize for interrupting, but whether it's this issue about validity is a claim or an issue, is it a question of validity, or is it a question of what does the assignment mean and what's the proper interpretation? You understand? Am I making myself
clear from the district court's order?
Well, what's your position? I mean, did you claim anywhere that the assignment was either invalid or valid? I mean, is that how it was framed and argued, or is it a question of what do the words mean?
The way that it was framed was that the assignment clouded title to the property and the cloud should be removed because the parties understood that the assignment was not intended to convey McGillis's interest in the property. It was intended simply as a power of attorney to authorize Thurston to pursue the appraiser litigation without McGillis's involvement. That it was solicited from McGillis, an over 80-year-old man, by his longtime agent, using false pretenses in breach of that agent's fiduciary duty, and was never explained to Mr. McGillis as an assignment of interest in property and never intended to be reported. But that's what both parties understood, as evidenced by, number one, the affidavit of Richard McGillis found in the record at pages 1546 to 1550, and in particular paragraphs 9 through 17, and as acknowledged by Mr. Thurston during his deposition in the Utah action, where he testified at that time that McGillis was the owner of the property, and further testified, and this is found at page 830 of the record, that there is no agreement between the parties respecting the property. So that was the basis for the quiet title claim. And that was the only claim in the court below. The issue, as framed by the district court in its order, is whether the assignment validly conveyed an interest in the property. And that issue is subject only to issue preclusion. And issue preclusion bars relitigation of an issue only where that issue was actually litigated and necessarily adjudicated in the prior proceeding. And it is undisputed that the assignment's validity was neither litigated nor adjudicated in the Utah action.
Excuse me, counsel. Now, you've said that the validity of the assignment, and that's a quotation, is not a claim. If the complaint had been amended to add a claim for declaratory judgment as to the validity of the assignment, could that have been a claim?
If the Utah action complaint had been amended to in fact add a claim for declaratory judgment, then yes, a claim for declaratory judgment would have been precluded under claim preclusion principles. And whether the assignment validly conveyed an interest in real property would have been an issue underlying the declaratory judgment claim. However, if a plaintiff is obligated to add a declaratory judgment claim to seek declaration of all disputed issues between the plaintiff and the defendant whenever such a dispute arises, or else in a subsequent proceeding, claim preclusion will bar the litigation of any issue that should have been subsumed within a declaratory judgment claim in a prior proceeding, issue preclusion will be eviscerated. No longer, claim preclusion will be the only preclusive principle available, because there, then the law will be that a plaintiff should have litigated all issues in a prior proceeding through the expedient of a deck action. And that is not the law. The law is that a plaintiff only should have brought all claims for relief then available, not litigated all issues then available. Only if the issues were actually litigated and necessarily adjudicated are they precluded, and it's undisputed that that did not happen here. Moreover, the district court dismissed FIF's issue preclusion defense on summary judgment, and FIF has not appealed that ruling. Similarly, the district court found in favor of McGillis in determining that the quiet title claim is not subject to claim preclusion, and FIF did not cross appeal that ruling either. Because the district court applied the elements of claim preclusion to bar McGillis from litigating the issue of the validity of the assignment, that alone justifies reversal. But even if the validity of the assignment is a claim, claim preclusion does not adhere, because the dispute over the assignment's validity did not arise until after the Utah action was filed. As this court held in Loveland, claim preclusion only bars claims that arose before the prior litigation was filed. Here, the dispute over the assignment's validity not only arose after the Utah action was filed, it arose after discovery was complete and the deadline for amendment of pleadings had passed.
Counsel, let me interrupt you on this sub-issue a little bit. Is your contention that it, as a matter of law, it's clear in the record that this claim arose after the fact? Or is your contention that there is a material disputed fact about when the claim arose? And if that's your contention, tell me what you think the disputed facts are in the record.
I believe it's clear. I believe it's crystal clear that there was no dispute prior to the filing of the Utah action. And this is evidenced primarily by Mr. Thurston's deposition in the Utah action, in where he stated at page 825 of the record that the property was owned by Mr. McGillis, and stated at page 830 of the record that there is no agreement between the parties respecting the property. However, and I have not heard any controverted evidence being presented by the defendant. To the extent the defendant, perhaps in argument, comes forward and says there actually is record evidence that this dispute over the assignment's validity arose prior to the filing of the Utah action, then it, at the very least, it's a disputed issue of material fact precluding summary judgment. Finally, we would ask for reversal of the district court's order with respect to our judicial estoppel defense. FIF is taking a position in this proceeding that is diametrically opposed to the position that it took throughout the Utah action, contending throughout and consistently throughout the Utah action that McGillis was the owner of the property. Took that position from April 2009, when the Utah action was filed, to October 2010, when it was decided. Now, in this state, FIF is taking the position that as early as November 2006, McGillis was not the owner of the property. These are irreconcilably inconsistent positions taken solely to benefit its interest in a given proceeding. And as FIF's Utah counsel testified under oath in this proceeding, taking that position in the Utah action worked considerably to FIF's advantage.
Yes, but counsel, once the assignment was precluded from coming into evidence, weren't they required to basically put on evidence that was consistent with the story they were allowed to tell?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Simply because McGillis filed a well-grounded motion in limine based on FIF's violation of Rule 26, and the court found that FIF had engaged in discovery abuse by submitting a late document, did not require FIF to insist that there be a multi-million-dollar offset to its damages. That was a calculated trial decision that it took. And the evidence is that it was planning to take that position throughout, which is why Mr. Thurston's testimony during his deposition prior to the order in limine was consistent with his testimony at trial after the order in limine. And it's further confirmed by the fact that FIF did not record the assignment until after the verdict was entered. This is a document that it had for 4 years. It didn't record it when the Utah action was filed, didn't record it when Mr. Thurston was questioned at his deposition about the property, didn't record it prior to trial, and then after the verdict, after the jury returned a verdict with a considerable decrease in damages, it then, after 4 years, recorded the document. The evidence is that this was a calculated trial strategy that worked.
Weren't they required? I mean, let me back up. Since the document couldn't come into evidence, is it your contention that if FIF had said at trial that it was the sole owner of the property, there wouldn't have been any penalty to FIF for saying that?
It's unclear whether the order in limine would have extended that far, but what judicial estoppel is designed to prevent is a party taking inconsistent positions in order to secure a benefit. Had it taken that position, had it simply acknowledged at trial that the state of the evidence is that it's the owner, judicial estoppel would not adhere. But instead, it took the position that it was the record owner of the property for the purpose of arguing for an offset in damages, something that it did not have to do, but elected to do because, as its counsel candidly admitted, it worked to its benefit to do that. That is what judicial estoppel is designed to prevent, and that's why we seek reversal. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Yes, counsel, you may.
May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Lynn Peters. I am Colorado Attorney Registration Number 31699. I am here today on behalf of the defendants, Paul Thurston, First Interstate Financial LLC, and First Interstate Financial Utah LLC. It occurs to me in listening to Mr. Factor's arguments and in reading the briefs that, according to my colleague, the only issue you need to decide is which bucket this issue or claim bucket word, so to speak, this should go into. If it is an issue, this validity of the assignment, then issue preclusion, we all agree, doesn't apply. If it is a claim, it appears the plaintiffs are conceding claim preclusion would bar it unless you find it's a late arising claim. We submit it's not a late arising claim, and I'll get to that in a moment. I think that determination, that first stance, that you have to pick a bucket, is too formalistic based on the rulings and the court's opinions about claim preclusion and issue preclusion. There are two ways in which anything previously litigated could be barred in subsequent litigation between the same parties, either claim preclusion or issue preclusion. And the court, in this case and in any case, should start with, does claim preclusion apply? And if not, then you look to issue preclusion. It should not matter formalistically whether you call it a claim or an issue. Even if you want to play this, which bucket does it go in, game, we submit that it is, in this case, that validity argument was not just an issue that's material to a quiet title claim. It is in and of itself a claim. I think, Judge Terry, you're the one who asked about if they had added a declaratory judgment claim. In this present case before you, they don't have to add it because it's there. They didn't call it a declaratory judgment claim. Their claim for quiet title says the assignment is invalid.
Well, I'm having trouble with understanding your argument, counsel, because in the Utah action, if they had amended the complaint to get a declaratory judgment and won, then yes, they would have a judgment that they could have then brought to Utah and get quiet title on. But the claims that were in the case at the time for breach of contract, I don't see how they could have come out with a declaratory judgment that the assignment was invalid. How could you get a portable judgment that the assignment was invalid without asserting a quiet title claim, I mean a declaratory judgment claim?
Well, I don't think it's I think the analysis for claim preclusion goes is focused on the injury for which the relief is sought.
I understand that.
And the injury,
but you've contended that they can no longer litigate the validity of the assignment.
Correct.
There's no such claim as, quote, validity of assignment, end quote. There is a claim for declaratory judgment. They didn't assert it. Are you contending they were required to amend their complaint to add it?
No, what we're contending is their basis of their challenge to the validity of the assignment, which would have been the basis for a declaratory judgment claim, is the same injury for which they did bring claims in 2009 in Utah.
Yes, but they might have gotten damages for breach of contract for that claim, but how could they get something that would preclude, that would be portable as a judgment that would let them get quiet title unless they asserted a declaratory judgment claim? It's they can't get assert that the assignment is invalid based on a breach of contract claim and get any relief for that. That's what I don't understand.
The relief they get is damages. They have to choose the relief they want and seek the relief, any relief they want.
Yes, but
at
you're
the
saying,
time they make the claim.
You're saying they can't then get quiet title here. All they get is damages. That's not the relief they sought.
Well, that is the relief they sought in the Utah case. I think the important thing is to look at the injuries they were claiming in the Utah case were that defendants First Interstate breached their fiduciary obligations to Mr. McGillis, that they tricked him and didn't fully disclose to him the terms of their entire joint venture with regard to all of their loans, including the Kersey loan, which is the transaction that gives rise to the case here in Colorado. They were seeking breach of contract for the specific agreement that this assignment was the consideration for, that they, Mr. McGillis, would receive the proceeds from the appraiser litigation that was brought by Mr. Thurston here in Colorado. They were alleging fraud and misrepresentation on Mr. Thurston's part with regard to all of his dealings with Mr. McGillis. This assignment is nothing more than part of those same complaints. It's the same injury. Their argument is, this assignment, you tricked me into signing this assignment. I didn't intend to do this, and you didn't tell me fully what it is I was signing.
That wasn't litigated in the Utah action.
That was litigated in the Utah action. That was the subject of the trial. You tricked me on these loans. You deceived
me. The assignment? You tricked me into signing the assignment?
Well, no, they chose not to litigate the assignment deliberately when they moved to exclude it from evidence. Regardless of why they moved to exclude it, they moved to exclude it from evidence, and the result of that was they made a conscious decision not to litigate the assignment in that case. But that move to exclude it, and the fact that they were arguing for the same group of injuries, the same overall transactions and series of transactions, is part and parcel with why they can't now argue those same issues here. I would also say that what they're asking for here is not really a quiet title case. What they're really saying is, out of equity, based on our overall treatment of how we did this joint venture, Mr. McGillis should be determined the 100% owner because of the breach of fiduciary duty, the breach of contract, and the misrepresentations. Well, those are all the same claims that they alleged they suffered an injury for in the Utah case. They had an opportunity to litigate all these issues. And I think focusing on when the dispute arose, focusing on when First Interstate may have first said, hey, wait a minute, why are we talking about this assignment? You gave me all of the interest in the property years ago, is not the focus this court should have. We should be looking at, when did Mr. McGillis have the information necessary to form his claim that the assignment was not valid?
And what's your position on that?
My position on that, Your Honor, is that he knew that, and at least two times. He knew it at the moment he signed it under his own theory, because the assignment clearly reads in plain language, I hereby give all right, title, and interest to the property to First Interstate. By signing this assignment, I give up any claim to the property. That document is clear on its face. Mr. McGillis is a longtime businessman. It was notarized by his longtime assistant who holds a degree in finance. That is a clearly understood document. If he really thought he was signing something that was merely a power of attorney, wouldn't he know at the moment he read that document and signed it that that was not what happened? And doesn't that give rise to his validity claim? even if you don't buy that he knew what he was signing at the time he signed it, in April of 2009, just before he filed that lawsuit, Mr. McGillis just says he discovered an overwhelming evidence of fraud and breach of fiduciary duty and failure to disclose material facts to him by his longtime business partner with regard to their entire joint venture, which would include the dealings and transactions involving the Kersey property, including this assignment and the deal that it was struck that led to the assignment in which he would receive the net proceeds from the appraiser lawsuit.
But if there's no pleading that expressly says that, isn't there an issue of fact of whether the inference that you're making that this would automatically include this assignment, doesn't that then become a question of fact?
I don't think that's a question of fact. I think it's just a matter of, well, if it is a question of fact, it's an undisputed question of fact based on the trial transcripts that came out from the Utah action, which are part of the court record. Those clearly show the extent and the length to which the parties in Utah focused in discovery on the Kersey loan and on the transactions, focused at trial on this assignment and who owned the property, that led to all the arguments during the jury trial about whether or not the property was or was not available to Mr. McGillis as a potential offset to damages. I think that record in Utah clearly shows, and the fact that both sides are citing so heavily to the Utah case shows that it was at issue in that Utah case. What my colleague is arguing is that we should be promoting the form and what they called the pleading in both cases over the substance of the injury for which they sought relief. To me, the declaratory judgment or the declaring it invalid is nothing more than an additional remedy that a plaintiff has available to it to remedy breach of fiduciary duty, to remedy fraud, or to set the record straight if their agreement is not being carried out the way you think it should. And well, all of those injuries are what they were arguing about in Utah.
So, I mean, the logical extent of the argument you're making is that claim preclusion applies here not because this could have been raised and decided in Utah, but that it actually was.
Well, the validity question...
Is that your argument?
The validity question was not raised, but I believe the basis for their claiming that the document is invalid, all of those issues were, in fact, debated and tried in the Utah case.
And decided?
Well, the jury heard, and they were asked to award damages by the plaintiff on the breach of the agreement by which the appraiser proceeds were to go to Mr. McGillis, and that's the agreement that spawned this assignment. So they made a breach of contract claim, and their claim now is because Mr. McGillis recorded this assignment, he did so in breach of that very agreement, which they've already litigated in Utah. So while the specific of this assignment is invalid or not was not decided in Utah, clearly they were talking about the overall agreement that forms the basis of their claim that it's invalid here. So it's an injury versus relief question, I think. Again, my colleague is conceding that the elements of claim preclusion are met. They're not arguing that those elements of claim preclusion do not apply here. What they're saying is this was not a claim. And I think as pled, this was a claim. And it is a claim that could have been brought in their Utah action. It's a claim they knew the facts about or should have known the facts about. I think Loveland Essential talks about it's not a late arising claim if the plaintiff knew or should have known of the facts that give rise to that claim at the time they filed this prior lawsuit.
Well, given the allegation that the plaintiff has made here, that there was a side agreement that the assignment itself was not what it said on its face, that the parties still jointly owned it, and that your client gave deposition testimony confirming that, and there were some communications back and forth confirming at least the what plaintiff says their understanding of it was. Isn't there at least an issue of fact that would preclude summary judgment as to whether it was a late arising claim?
I think that would be true if the testimony were as represented by my colleague. What the testimony shows from the deposition that was taken in the Utah case is that Mr. Thurston said, I believe the property is currently owned by both First Interstate and Mr. McGillis. That was the state of record title at the time. Same thing at trial. And at trial, in the trial transcripts, he actually uses the phrase, record title is held by. And that was true. As my colleague pointed out, there was an inadvertent failure to record this assignment until after the Utah trial, an oversight. As the record shows from the letters that first were exchanged between Utah counsel for both sides, nobody knew this assignment was in question until it was Mr. McGillis's side who said, well, wait a minute.
So doesn't that create at least an issue of fact that would preclude entry of summary judgment?
I don't believe so because of the language of the assignment itself. I think that assignment is so clear on its face that it is an unreasonable argument to look at somebody and say, well, yes, I signed a document that says I give away all right, title, and interest in this property. I give up any claim to this property, but that's not really what we meant, and I shouldn't be held to what I signed. I think that's unreasonable, and it's a convenient argument to make when you're trying now to say, well, wait a minute, I didn't know there was an issue till later on down the road. And I think you have to look at what did First Interstate know. First Interstate receives an assignment that's clear on its face. He's reached an agreement that he will pursue an appraiser lawsuit, the net proceeds of which will go to Mr. McGillis, his partner. He keeps the property. He files that lawsuit. He provides over $265,000 of net proceeds to Mr. McGillis pursuant to that agreement. He then gets sued for fraud and all sorts of nefarious things in Utah. At no time is anybody claiming Mr. McGillis owns the property until they get to 4 months before trial. And even then, the response back from Mr. McGillis's counsel and his response to the June letters was, this is just more evidence, part and parcel, of what we think you did wrong in this case. And then they don't get to talk about the assignment at trial. But there's never a time when, completely lost my train of thought, I apologize.
It happens.
There's not a time when that assignment becomes so, there's a claim made, or Mr. McGillis is trying to do something with the property that would lead Mr. Thurston to say, oh, I need to record this today. And there, and the fact of recording is of no consequence to his claim against validity. The facts that give rise to his claim about validity of the assignment, he knew at the time he signed that document, because he knew what it said, and he knows there's no other agreement. And I don't think the deposition testimony on which my colleague relies does in fact support his argument that there was a side agreement. I think that's their interpretation of two sentences of deposition testimony. And I think in this case, the court looked at the proper inquiry. The court here focused on the injury that was sought and looked at, and I encourage you to read their actual claim. I think it's paragraph 63 in their complaint here. Their claim for invalidity of the assignment reads like a breach of fiduciary duty, breach of contract claim, the remedy for which they want an order declaring it invalid. And when you compare that with the injuries, what they were seeking relief for in the Utah case, it's the same. The trial court here recognized it and applied claim preclusion, and we think the trial court was right in doing so. A very short amount of time to address judicial estoppel. First, what I will say about judicial estoppel just briefly is, it's not enough, even if you assume there were inconsistent positions taken, even if you assume there was an intentional plan to do that, which the trial court here found there was not, and I think the record shows it was not intentional. There has to be an actual benefit. I think Burford talks in terms of prevailing party. You have to prevail on that position that you took. And in this case, there's no evidence, there's no way to tell what the jury actually relied on in issuing its ruling. So there was no actual benefit here.
Thank you, counsel. I see that your time has expired. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Peters said that if you find that the validity of the assignment is an issue and not a claim, that we win. That is correct, because a party is not obligated to litigate all disputed issues, only obligated to state all available claims. She also said that even if it is a claim, if it's a late arising claim, we win. That's correct also. However, she said that absent those two things, we would lose, and that's not correct. There's a third basis on which we prevail, which is the traditional claim preclusion analysis, which includes as an element whether there's an identity of claims. And there's no identity of claims here between the claims stated in the Utah action and the validity of the assignment, assuming that's a claim. In the Utah action, the claims, and again, what the cases say is that whether there's an identity of claims depends on whether it arises out of the same transaction, and whether it arises out of the same transaction depends on whether the claims seek to redress the same injury, so you look at the injury to be redressed. And in the Utah action, the injury to be redressed was Thurston's deceitful conduct in originating loans by taking too great an origination percentage for himself and by not disclosing his interest in the borrowers of the loans. The injury sought to be redressed here is Thurston's actions in submitting an assignment for collateral of one of the pieces of property to Mr. McGillis under false pretenses, and then later recording it despite essentially saying that he would not do so. There is also an extreme difference in time. The Kersey loan facts litigated in Utah related to the origination of the loan in 2003 and whether Mr. Thurston took too great an origination percentage at that point. The current action relates to the recordation of the assignment in October of 2010. So even if you apply the traditional claim preclusion analysis without regard to Loveland and the after arising fact jurisprudence, there is not an identity of claims here. Finally, the parties did not litigate at trial this supposed agreement that FIF contends took place, where Mr. McGillis agreed to give an assignment in exchange for Thurston pursuing the litigation. In fact, at page 699 of the record, Thurston does not acknowledge such an agreement, and at page 833 of the record in his deposition, the same is true. We ask for reversal. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments and your briefs. We appreciate them very much. And you will receive a written opinion in due course. The case will stand. It's submitted as is.